You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Hello and welcome to everybody in this room and to those of us who are joining us by video from Washington and London. I'm Mark Schoofs, and I'm an Open Society Fellow on leave from my job as a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And the Open Society Fellowship Program is very pleased to host today's event. I'm thrilled to have Paul Steiger talk with us about the future of news. And that future is turbulent. Recently, the Washington Post company announced that its 2008 fourth quarter earnings were down a stunning 77% from a year earlier, and that its newspaper division is operating at a loss. The New York Times company carries $1 billion in debt and recently had to sell its headquarters and lease back the office space in order to raise cash. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer will probably go out of business this week, and it looks like the San Francisco Chronicle is shutting down as well. Now, we have to be frank. Some of this carnage is self-inflicted. Personally, I know reporters at national newspapers, not just, by the way, the Wall Street Journal, but at other papers, who still resist learning how to shoot video or even still photography because, you know, they're stuck in their ways or they don't believe anachronistically that it's their job. Yet, in the last 2 years, more than 11,250 journalists have lost their jobs, according to the Columbia Journalism Review. And by no means were most of those people lazy or incompetent. Now, a lot of industries are shedding jobs, so why should we care especially about journalists? And the reason is because, on the whole, despite mistakes made by the news business, we have lost a perilous number of eyes and ears and brains who are seeking out information and presenting it in a way that is accessible to millions of people. And in fact, the papers that remain provide less news. In 2006, the Boston Globe closed all of its foreign bureaus, and the LA Times, which serves the country's second largest metropolitan area, is likely to close its Baghdad bureau within a year, despite the fact that there are thousands of Americans and billions of American dollars still at risk in that country, and despite the fact that the bureau there has two of the most prolific and smartest reporters in the region. Investigative teams, which require full-time reporters to spend weeks or months on stories that may lead nowhere, is expensive to do, does not pull in advertising, and as a result, many papers are letting their investigative teams go. And of course, the irony is that all of this has happened at the very moment when blogs, social networking sites, iPods, Kindles, and all manner of media and delivery vehicles have blossomed. Shooting video or taking photographs has never been cheaper or easier, and citizen journalism has never been stronger. The recent election proved how hungry people are for news. But traditionally, it is newspapers that have been the venue where the best, most aggressive, investigative, and foreign news coverage has been found. And so, today's topic is, given the disastrous decline of newspapers and the rise of new media, what is the future of news? To help us answer that question, we are joined by Paul Steiger, who has a rare and valuable combination of old school and new school experience. Currently, Paul is the editor-in-chief, president, and chief executive of ProPublica, a new not-for-profit investigative website that has already made an impact through stories ranging from how natural gas drilling imperils the water supply to overseas bribery committed by multinational corporations such as Siemens, and to the Bush administration's troubled effort to launch an Arab-language television news station. ProPublica has a staff of 28 journalists that includes veteran investigative reporters as well as Young Turks, and just this month, Paul snagged Amanda Mickle, who ran the Huffington Post's groundbreaking Off the Bus feature, which enlisted 12,000 citizen reporters and 1,700 writers, and which broke such campaign-changing stories as Obama's famous bitter quote. Now, from 1991 till 2007, Paul was managing editor of the Wall Street Journal. Now, at most papers, managing editor means that you're one of several deputy papers. But at the Wall Street Journal, that term essentially means that you are the editor-in-chief. And under Paul's leadership, the paper won 16 Pulitzer Prizes on topics ranging from the advent of new AIDS treatments to the fall of Enron to the terrorist attacks of 9/11. We've asked Paul to open our conversation by briefly describing ProPublica and contrasting it with the Wall Street Journal, and then to address some or all of the following questions. What will the news landscape look like in 5 to 10 years, and why? Where will Americans get quality investigative and foreign news? How much of that investigative and foreign news will be generated by for-profit and how much by nonprofit organizations? And what kind of news will suffer the most and what kinds will flourish? Finally, on a personal note, I should say that I moved to the Wall Street Journal from, of all places, the Village Voice because of Paul Steiger. I also worked under his leadership during 9/11 and in the wrenching aftermath of that attack. Paul encouraged me to write stories on everything from Merck slashing the price of AIDS drugs to the FBI's hunt for the anthrax mailer to how ordinary Congolese citizens living hundreds of miles from the nearest paved road and unknown to any American were surviving a little-known but catastrophic war. He is a smart, fair, and thoughtful editor. In fact, he's one of the great journalists of our time, and it is a pleasure and an honor to welcome Paul Steiger to the Open Society Institute. Paul.
Thank you very much, Mark, and I'm delighted to be here for a number of reasons. First, because you asked me, and I always loved working with you. Secondly, because OSI is a great supporter of a place where I also am active, the Committee to Protect Journalists, chairman, and I think it's fair to say that CPJ would have had a much harder time getting off the ground had it not been for the early and continuing support, for which we're very grateful. My life has changed in many ways, but not in the principal way, which is that what energizes me most is going after news, and particularly news that people don't want to make announcements about. The difference is that when I come in the morning, instead of having 700 journalists to work with, I have 28. The disadvantage of that, of course, is that there are fewer things that you can cover. The advantage is that we have no have-to covers, no routine news that people are depending on us for to be comprehensive about, but rather only those stories which we feel will make the biggest difference, either because the stories themselves have impact or because nobody else is doing them. And it's been a great joy for me to, starting from an empty office space in Lower Manhattan at the beginning of 2008, to have been able to get together with a team of outstanding journalists, both veterans who have their roots in the print world and young folks who have come up through the internet and through video. And the one of the great joys of my life is seeing them interact and learn from each other. The business of news and the activity of gathering and marshaling news and distributing it is changing so fast that it's very hard to say where we will be in 2 years, let alone 5 years or 10. So I think the the best that I can do to try to kick off at what I hope will be a freewheeling discussion here is to give a little bit of a sense of how we got to where we are and to suggest where we're heading and how that might change. Exactly when those changes will occur, again, it's hard to predict, except that I suspect it will be faster than we suppose. Mark laid out for you the basic negatives of the collapse of the Metro newspaper business model, and those negatives are severe, and I want to talk a little more about them. But I do want to remind people that what caused the collapse of that business model, namely the rise of the web, is not all negative. There are lots of things that one can point to that represent positive changes for the consumers of news. Why did the rise of the web destroy newspapers' business model? Very simply, that before the internet came along, newspapers were necessary. If you wanted to know more than a surface understanding of events that were significant in the world or significant to you, you needed a newspaper. If you wanted to know more than the television, radio headlines about international or national news, if you wanted to know local news in any depth at all, you had to buy a newspaper. If you didn't care about those things, but you really wanted to know what happened to your portfolio of 6 to 60 stocks, you needed a newspaper. If you were interested in sports teams outside your local area, you needed a newspaper. If you wanted to know more than the weather in your immediately local region, you needed a newspaper. And for a very cheap price, you got not only the things you needed, but things you might like to have as well. It was a tremendous bargain that lasted for many years, and it survived the rise of television news. It survived the rise of cable news, which could have done a more effective job at narrowcasting, at targeting specific audiences than it did, and so therefore still left a broad domain for newspapers whose revenue was breaking records well into the change in the millennium. But when the web came along and became in general use and the methods for accessing the web became more widespread and flexible, the newspapers role changed from being something that one had to have to something that was nice to have. It's a nice briefing package. It's portable. You have the advantage of editors choosing a package of news for you. You have the serendipity effect, which means you will see a headline and it will draw you into a story you didn't know you were interested in. All of those things are nice, but they don't make a newspaper necessary. And so more and more people are getting their news and information on the web where it is free. And it's in greater profusion in most respects, or at least in many respects, than newspapers used to provide. If you care about business, you can get certainly all the statistical information you could possibly dream of, and it's free. If you're not about sports, the same way. If you care about announcement news, all of the wires appear essentially free and available to you. Secondly, it's instantaneous. You don't have to wait till the morning. And the final thing is opinion, which is in greater profusion relative to the size of the society, maybe since the founding of the Republic, certainly since the Civil War. So there are a lot of positive elements here, but two of the elements most important to the success of democracy, namely investigative reporting and foreign reporting, have gotten hammered and are going to be hammered more. Why? As Mark suggested, they are expensive to do. If the I team doesn't produce a story tomorrow, you're not going to get a call from somebody wondering where it is. If the the person who covers the local sports team does not write, you will get a call. And so therefore, as newspapers try to hold on to their readers and advertisers, they have to fill the jobs where there's immediacy of reader demand and interest. The things that may be more crucial to them in the long run, understanding the world outside and digging deeply into the world closer at hand, that is not perceived so urgently, and therefore, when editors and publishers make cuts, it's those areas which are among the first to go. Some examples of why we should worry a lot about this. I was a judge on the Selden Ring investigative reporting contest. It's administered out of the University of Southern California, and it has a single prize of $35,000 for the best investigative work of the previous year, and it therefore draws a lot of entries. And in spite of all the turmoil in the business, there were lots of excellent entries. There were between 60 and 70 entries, and I would say half of them were really strong. And what you saw was, you know, even in the case of some death rows of newspapers, still doing what we have counted on newspapers to do. The winner was Newsday, which did a remarkable series of articles, didn't start out as a series, but grew into a series on the abuse of local school districts and other special districts to provide special pensions and other emoluments for people that frankly didn't deserve them. And Newsday's coverage produced a legislative change within the year that it appeared to make it far more difficult to conduct that abuse. The Detroit Free Press got a hold of here's a case of print using the internet to wreak havoc. It got a hold of emails between the mayor of Detroit and his chief aide, which gave the lie to their testimony, their sworn testimony, that A, they were not having an affair, and B, they did not conspire to fire a particularly troublesome city employee. Result, they both lost their jobs, and they both went to jail. Would not have happened but for the existence of a courageous local newspaper. Finally, the Boston Globe, in a series that was mentioned just today in its sister paper, the New York Times, did a marvelous expose of collaboration between the biggest hospital company formed by a merger of two of the great hospitals in the world and Blue Cross Blue Shield to raise prices, in effect, through an agreement that the lawyers for both sides warned participants should not be written down, and yet the newspaper was able to expose it, and the governor is on the warpath. There have been investigations by the antitrust authorities. All three of these were crucially important to the local community, had echoes nationally, and would not have been done but for not print newspaper, because this could have been transmitted over the internet, but would not have been done but for the grouping of trained, capable, and courageous journalists who were prepared to dig deep and spend many weeks, if not months, to bring the story to bring their stories to public attention. In a state where I spent some of my growing up, and a state which is not unknown to corruption, New Jersey, a few years ago in the Trenton State House, there were more than 25 reporters. I'm now told there are only a half dozen or so. What that means is that there will be misbehaviors that will go unreported and therefore unchanged, and there will be misbehaviors that wouldn't have been attempted a few years ago that will be attempted and carried out, and that's all bad. Okay, so where is relief going to come from? First of all, there are some institutions which will survive and which do have investigative reporting as part of their value proposition or their institutional DNA. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, they will be here in 5 years. They will be here in 10. The ownership structure may be different, but they are sufficiently unusual that I'm quite confident they will survive, and this kind of reporting is crucial for them. Outfits like The New Yorker, like Vanity Fair, which do this, some other magazines which do this will survive, and new magazines will crop up. Old magazines will get larger and more important, because while it's easy to for a magazine to go out of business, it's also, for reasons we don't need to go into here, it's also easier for a magazine to start up than it is for a newspaper. Secondly, the wires are relatively robust. Their business models have not been shattered the way newspapers have. Bloomberg, in particular, the last time I checked, was experiencing an increase in revenue, not a decline, and was still adding journalists. The AP and Reuters, while they have been doing some cutting back, are still relatively robust. And I think that the economics of television phenomena like 60 Minutes will continue to be strong. That helps on the local front. I mean, on the national and international front, it does not help on the local front. Also helping in the national and international domain is that some web entities which have grown up are beginning to realize that if they want to keep their traffic growing, it's not enough to have a combination of announcement news and people opining in their pajamas, that exclusive news does drive eyeballs, and Arianna Huffington, for example, told me last fall that she was going to set aside $1 million this year in her budget for the Huffington Post to add investigative reporters for just this reason. She recently made the announcement, and it's $2 million, not one. So the trend there is in the right direction. But it will take a long time before those efforts will make up for the folks who've already been lost in the downturn. Another domain where there's new energy is with web-only local news organizations. They start from a much smaller base because they don't do a lot of the legacy stuff that that newspaper newsrooms still do, and so instead of news budgets from, you know, $20 million to $200 million, they can get by on a news budget of $750,000 or $1.5 million. But their ability to go really deep into a subject is limited. And secondly, and I worry a lot about this, they don't have the legal backup to be able to fight off not just a legitimate libel suit, but the threat of a libel suit. So the landscape now, and I'm coming to an end here because I would like to open up to your questions and comments, but the landscape now is one of very rapid change. Newspapers, print newspapers are shrinking, and quite a few of them are going to fold, are going to shut their doors. Meantime, some newspapers will survive. Some will continue to do investigative reporting. Television and magazines will provide some. There is the beginning of a movement of local online reporting networks. While crowdsourcing is not the panacea that some of the most passionate advocates envision it as being, it does have strong potential, and people like Amanda Mickle, who I'm so glad walked into our office for the first time today as an employee, will help the rest of me and the rest of my colleagues figure out how to make better use of that. All of this is a platform that will make it possible at some point for something to occur, which happened in the 20th century. My colleagues, maybe not including Mark at the Wall Street Journal, thought I covered the Civil War. But between the end of the Civil War and the start of the 20th century, there were many, many partisan newspapers. If you picked up a newspaper, the odds were reasonably good that it would have Republican or Democrat in its name. In other words, opinion-driven, blog-driven news is not a stranger to our society. What happens when that's the only kind of news you can get is that people start looking for folks who will tell them not what they just what they want to hear, but what they need to hear. And that may happen in the form of high-priced newsletters to folks who are making business decisions based on data. But at some point, the cycle will turn again. Whether that happens in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years or more, your guess is as good as mine. I think that's enough for me. I'd be delighted to respond to questions and comments you might have.
Let me just briefly say again that everything, your questions as well, are being recorded. And does anybody have a question that they would like to pose? And you need to speak into a microphone. Would you like to start?
I'd be glad to. Hi, Minky Warden from Human Rights Watch, an admirer of Paul's in all of his various capacities at the CPJ and other places. Did you see the blog post by Clay Shirky that's been making its way around the blogosphere over the weekend? He posits that actually you're wrong and that in the immediate future, it's time for news organizations to start thinking the unthinkable, which is that the Washington Post and the Times might not be around in the very near future. Can you give us your thoughts about that, but also about the possibility that groups funded by OSI, like Human Rights Watch, CPJ, and others, who are actually doing, we have the investigative journalism in our DNA, we're doing investigative journalism, we call it research and documentation, and it's often taken by media. How would you, what sort of a future do you see for NGOs who do this type of work moving into the investigative field in a more direct way?
Thanks for a very good question, Minky, and the admiration is mutual. First of all, I can understand concerns about even the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. At the New York Times, you can buy a share of stock for the price of the Sunday newspaper, and the economic pressures are huge. But remember, we're now going through not just a huge cyclical, permanent transformation, but we're having a huge cyclical downturn. And recessions harm advertising. This recession is deep enough to wipe out a lot of advertising. So it's exaggerating the economic pressures on these institutions. And yes, it's not a walk in the park, but I do think they'll survive. How important are philanthropy-supported operations like Human Rights Watch and my own ProPublica? I think they can be significant, and I think as more of them come into being with different foci, the combination of them all can be more important. But I think absent a robust for-profit journalistic environment, we're not going to get back to anything like the kind of resource that we've had, particularly in the last 30 years. And I think that resource is crucially important to the functioning of democracy. So whether it's the search for a new and workable business model for in-depth journalism, or whether it's some broader kind of government support, some modern-day analog of the second-class publishing subsidy, which is available across a broad base. Absent that, it's going to be rocky going.
Let me just also say, if anybody in London or D.C. wants to chime in, raise your hand, because I can see you easier that way. Yes.
Hi, Ann Nelson. First of all, I've really been enjoying and valuing the ProPublica stories that I get, which happen to reach me through the listserv. I'm curious about when you started out with your business model regarding distribution and its access to published venues and ways of reaching the public, how that has played out since you launched, and how your audience is divided up between traditional print, broadcast, listserv, and other ways of reaching your audience.
Thank you, Anne. For those of you who don't know, our model is that through a generous $10 million a year grant, principally from the Sandler Foundation, but also with help from MacArthur and Atlantic and Mary Graham and some others, we are able to fund all of our news gathering and distribution without advertising or circulation revenue. And our model is to make a broad base of our coverage, which includes not just our own reporting, but aggregation of other people's investigative reporting, because I think that too much good investigative reporting becomes roadkill because it doesn't get adequate distribution. And so every day we try to assemble and in some cases comment on other people's investigative reporting. But then for our own deep dive stuff, we try to place it on a temporary exclusive with existing platforms with large audiences or crucially focused audiences, so that we can have the most impact from our own stories. And that's been so far very successful. Our first major story was on 60 Minutes. We've been on the we've been the lead story in the Sunday New York Times. We've been at the top of the page at USA Today. We've been on the front page multiple times of the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago. We've been in the Chicago Tribune, the Denver Post, maybe 30 newspapers around the country. We've also been on radio, most often public radio, and we've found a tremendous affinity for other websites, whether it's their specialized sites like Politico or HuffPost or general sites like MSN. They are very good partners, and we've partnered with maybe another 15 or 20 websites. So that part has gone pretty much as we expected. What has gone faster than I'd initially expected, although it's still early days, is our own website, which houses our archive and which is the default distribution point for whatever we do. And it's been growing quite rapidly. You know, it's still relatively small. I think we had something like 700,000 page views last month, but it grows just about every day. And the people who sign up to get our, you know, RSS feeds, the people who follow us on Twitter, again from a small base, but it's growing pretty rapidly. And my expectation is that growth will continue.
I was just going to ask, have any of these traditional platforms, you know, the 60 Minutes or the Times or whatever, have any of them refused to take your content, and have any of them have had any concerns about, you know, the Sandlers are perceived to be, for example, left of center. So was there any concerns or any talking through that you had to do around a perception that the reporting might be biased?
We have had, of course, numerous cases where people we talked to decided not to use our content. But this was always, to the best of my ability to perceive it, for journalistic reasons. They were already doing something like it, or they didn't think it was right for their readers, or, you know, sort of a variety of journalistic reasons. Some people have raised the question about the Herb and Marian Sandler's propensity to support moderately left of center organizations. But again, to the best I've been able to understand, they have been prepared to take us at our word that we're aiming straight down the middle. And as you know from your experience at the Wall Street Journal, that was where I attempted to lead the news coverage. And I was reporting to a publisher and a chairman of the board who was at least as conservative as the Sandlers are liberal, and was able to do it at the at the Journal, and we get picked up by the right wing blogs with some of our coverage, and you know, as well as by the left and center ones. So I think we're so far we've been successful at trying to go down the middle, and I think our partners recognize that and have not used that as a reason for not working with us.
Let's take a question that's down there. Maybe the fellow in the blue. You have the mic, so you go ahead.
Micha Sifri with the Personal Democracy Forum, and also an advisor to the Sunlight Foundation, and big fan of what ProPublica is doing. A quick one and then a real one. The first is, just to be sure, did you read Clay Shirky's piece, or you haven't had a chance to read it yet?
I have not had a chance to read it yet.
That's what I thought.
But I've heard the arguments.
Well, you should read his new one because it's better than his previous. The question I was going to ask you is about another piece that's circulating online now from the writer Stephen Johnson, who argues that we're actually living in what might almost be characterized as the beginning of a golden age for news. And he suggests that we're just seeing everything backwards. And he argues from the emergence of what he calls an old growth forest level of ecology of information around technology information, which is the most robust online sector. And then he goes from there to look at the explosion of political coverage online and the millions of people who are flocking to political websites, including the big newspapers like the New York Times. And so as newspapers go down, political web readership is going up, and that what we have here is the rise of a very healthy ecology. So I want to ask you, first of all, go take a look at Stephen Johnson's argument, but I want to ask you, is it possible that instead of mourning the loss of jobs, we should be celebrating this explosion of participation and involvement online?
Well, as I think I said before, there's a lot right now to praise in the environment. There are lots of things that consumers of news have access to now that they didn't before. There's no question about that. But I am not persuaded that we can just simply cruise along and the old growth, new growth forest will automatically provide a substitute for professional investigative reporting. This really came home to me as I was reading the entries in that contest out in Los Angeles, where one could see the important effect of journalistic discipline in producing the impact that these stories and these series had. I think that a lot of good things are going to emerge from the natural development of the internet and the blogosphere, no question about it. But I also think that we need to look hard for a replacement for stuff that is really important to society.
I want to follow up a little bit on that and challenge you, because I know that one of the in our conversations with Lenny and Aria and Steve, I think it was Aria who was mostly concerned that investigative journalism might survive, but foreign reporting, which is very expensive and which requires some sort of cultural translation to understand, say, the Middle East for an American reader, would be very hard hit. And obviously ProPublica is mostly investigative, but you led a tremendous expansion of foreign reporting at the Wall Street Journal, so maybe you could comment on what you think the future of foreign reporting in the United States is in the new environment.
I totally agree with you about the crucial importance of foreign reporting. And, I think that as more Americans travel, and including at an early age, it becomes easier to tap into indigenous reporting, both professional reporting and web reporting from overseas, and so that may provide that may provide some help. Gathering journalistic activities that begin overseas. Successor as the editor at the Wall Street Journal, Robert Thompson, is a native of Australia who has worked in Asia and Europe, and he kind of embodies that global perspective, and I think can make use of indigenous material. But having said that, that kind of translation function, and I don't mean just translating a story written in a foreign language, but the ability to take an American perspective, go overseas, and bring home important stories in a way that are accessible to the vast mass of American readers and most importantly, to opinion leaders in America, that still is going to be necessary. And there are some incipient movements. There's a group in Boston that's for profit. I've forgotten the name, and they're making an early start into trying to build a network of in essence, captive freelance reporters overseas, and that is one toe in the water. Something that's been around longer is the Pulitzer Center in Washington, which provides small stipends to help reporters get overseas to do reporting. Things like this can help. I also think that there will that because so much of people's economic livelihoods are driven by things that happen outside this country, there will be a market for good information that one can make business and career decisions on from overseas. How that turns itself into a business model, your guess is as good as mine.
Does anybody watching from a video link want to ask a question? I just don't want to have you folks feel like you are being left out. Speak now or forever hold your peace. All right. Tom. Yes, if you could send him one that way.
Two small questions, if I could. David Carr had a piece in the New York Times not too long ago suggesting that there needed to be a legislative response, that a lot of the restrictions on collaboration by different newspapers in the same market no longer make sense. and that this might be loosening some of those restrictions might be a way to allow these newspapers to be more lean and mean, more competitive, and stay alive longer. What is your thought on that? Second question, and again, a lot of people have kicked this idea around. Why don't all the big newspapers and even some of the smaller ones stop giving their product away for free? Why isn't there a bigger move to, again, put the sort of draw the curtain the way that I believe the Wall Street Journals and a couple of other papers do? Wouldn't that also potentially have a positive impact?
In both cases, I worry a little bit about horses and barn doors. In the case of communities where there's more than one newspaper, that list is shrinking. I mean, the Rocky Mountain News just closed. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer is about to close. Other places where there have been joint operating agreements, they're suffering under the weight of the deteriorating economics. Charging for content, there are certainly a lot of horses out of the barn, but whether some can be rounded up and sent back in, is a live question. Bill Keller, the executive editor of the New York Times, appeared to open the door to that on his own website a few weeks ago. You know, if in 1998, when Google went beta, the newspaper industry, which at the time was enjoying record profits, had looked ahead and gotten together and said, here's our version of ASCAP. Just as radio stations play to air music, here's what we'll charge you to carry our content. The world we're looking at today might be quite different. That didn't happen, and now people are very used to getting information for free. And my colleagues at newspapers agonizingly point out how much of the true fresh content on the web really has as its origin newspaper reporting. But if one were to try to go from here to there, for example, if the Washington Post or the New York Times were to say, henceforth, you pay, the number of eyeballs would drop because the search engines would hit them less often. And so therefore, the ad revenues might be expected to decline. And so, maybe you would get to an increase in revenue ultimately, but you'd have to go through another slough of despond. And so the pathway to get there, I'm not saying it's impossible at all. I think it's well worth thinking about, but it's not easy.
Yes, in the back there.
Calvin Sims from the Ford Foundation.
Hi, Calvin.
Hi. I want to follow up on this question of having to pay, and especially with ProPublica and various other not-for-profit news organizations that are springing up. Is that the best model for sustainability in the long run? And could you not charge some of the partners who publish your reporting, could you not charge them a fee to actually carry this vital investigative reporting? And should we be thinking in that way starting out and not ending up where the papers are today?
Very, very good question. When we started ProPublica, the notion was that we needed to get the right audience for each story. It was hard enough to get impact from investigative reporting. I mean, I've seen over the years how often good stories don't result in change because they're not followed up. So therefore, our focus was, how do we put these stories in the hands of people so that they can affect change? But I do believe that the not-for-profit arena is best seen as an avenue for experimentation and some leadership and trying out of things, but that traditionally the for-profit model is the one that, when it's successful, it attracts imitation, and that's where you get a critical mass. So what I would hope would happen is that people can see from what we do a pathway to produce something that there's a public demand for, and then can find a way to make it part of a business model that works. In the meantime, once we get the journalism right, and you know, we had a good first year, but we have a long way to go, we ourselves will look for ways to supplement the philanthropy that we receive with either small gifts or actual fee for service revenue.
You were gonna get that other one.
Two very good questions, Michael. First of all, yes, the nonprofit sector has been hammered, but from what I can see, and it's anecdotal, not systematic, but I see news being a greater emphasis, even as the money is tighter, I've seen talk of a greater news. I don't want to put Calvin on the spot, but at Ford, I'm a trustee of Knight, and news is remaining a strong element of Knight's portfolio. But sure, the reduction of wealth of philanthropic organizations is certainly in the intermediate term going to play a role. One of our smaller funders, Jet, closed its door because of the Madoff. They had all their money with Madoff, unfortunately, and just shut down. So that certainly is an issue for the intermediate term. The question about whether news organizations, and one has to separate the physical print newspaper from the news organization that puts it out. I mean, example, the Detroit Free Press is now only distributing the print paper, I think 3 days a week. The rest of the time, they're producing it, but they're essentially distributing it online. Why? Because they've concluded they only make money 3 days of 3 days of the week. So, but they're still producing some strong coverage. And while they've had layoffs and have shrunk the size of a news organization, they are still doing some aggressive coverage. And I think that one of the great disappointments to news organizations has been how difficult in the past year or so their websites have become. I mean, a couple of years ago, a number of news organizations were envisioning that crossing of the lines, where they would be getting more revenue from online than from print, and ultimately could shrink or even shut down the print side. What's happened is two things. One which is long term, which is that search has proved more effective, at least for now, at delivering the right eyeballs to advertisers. So when print publications take their advertisers to their websites, the first thing that happens is they get a check from their advertisers. The second thing that happens is the advertisers get a call from their media buyers saying, listen, if you're going to do this, do it through Google. It's cheaper and more effective. And so Google or Yahoo or whatever search entity has been siphoning off a certain amount of advertising that once would have gone to newspapers. The second thing is the one that I alluded to before, which is that in this deep recession, the total amount of advertising is not growing. In fact, it's shrinking in many domains, and at the same time that as more and more bloggers come aboard every day, as there's more and more content on the web, the available page views to hit your web ad to is growing enormously. So advertising shrinking, web views growing, the result is the price just is dropping like a rock, and that is making the economics of journalistic websites more difficult. If you get a recovery, then some of that will change. There'll be more money for advertising, and the rates may stabilize. But certainly in the intermediate term, yeah, there's definitely reason to be concerned. But I come back to the notion that the service of in-depth investigative reporting, foreign reporting, has value to a large portion of society. They may not see it now, but they will see it, and the platforms exist for when they do see it, for it to come back.
Yes, go ahead.
You know, it strikes me as somewhat anomalous. We have this strange world where we have these for-profit ventures, which are kind of dying, and then we have all this philanthropic money kind of trying to put them on a breathing machine so that they can get their messages out to the world. One, looking at that, wonders why not just cut to the chase then and set up something that actually not only generates the information in the news, such as Human Rights Watch does, and also has a vector for getting it out. I'm wondering what, finally, your sort of feeling is about the virtues of the marketplace. It seems to me the marketplace is collapsing. We're nationalizing the banks. In effect, we're kind of philanthropizing the media. Something's really wrong here, that we've got a marriage, it seems to me, between two things that don't quite fit together. Thoughts?
You see, Paul, you came from a place which was free people, free markets, and now you're at the Open Society Institute. Go ahead.
Right. Well, you know, sure, the banks are collapsing, newspapers are collapsing, and lots of other businesses are suffering, but not all of them are suffering the way those and the auto companies and a few other salient ones will. And, we've had recessions before. We've even had deep recessions before. The 1980-82 recession was still significantly deeper than this one, and I hope this one doesn't overtake it, although it could. So I don't think that what we're seeing is the end of business in our society. And the virtues of the for-profit model is that it does attract imitation willy-nilly, and you get critical mass much faster. The problem of replacing newspapers or shoring up newspapers from philanthropy is that the numbers just don't fit. I mean, there's ProPublica, which is one of the better funded of these operations, is $10 million a year. We've seen hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe even billions of dollars, vaporized in the newspaper business. So while I think the not-for-profit domain can help, the notion that not-for-profits can shore up, the Philadelphia Inquirer and the San Francisco Chronicle and the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and so on. The money's just not there.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Steve.
I'm Steve Hubble of the of OSI, of the Open Society Fellowship Program and the Soros Justice Fellowship Program. My question is this. Couldn't an argument be made that investigative reporting has been in crisis for 30 years, if not longer, and that has never, for its own sake, been a market-worthy, sustainable undertaking, that it has stowaway'd on the more profitable services that newspapers have provided? I remember a conversation at Mother Jones Magazine 20-plus years ago. We had received I was an intern at the time, we had received five or six national magazine awards for investigative reporting, and there was a lot of talk in the office about fatigue among the readership arising from certain problems with investigative reporting. Contextlessness, in other words, why should a reader in Florida care about fraud in the utility commission of Mariposa County? Why should people in Mariposa County care about fraud in the utility commission? And that even though I didn't have the courage to raise it at the time, I could have asked, if not for the promise of yet another national magazine award lying in wait for us, would we have been so inspired to undertake these very expensive investigative projects? And you could say that if not for the intervention of a certain philanthropic agency, the Pulitzer Foundation, that investigative reporting might well have proved itself to be economically unviable a long time ago, and that, as Orville says, in effect, we should just admit that reality is reality and shift over to the philanthropic model because nothing else will sustain it for the long term.
Well, that's an interesting argument. I'm reminded of the humorist Dave Barry's line, warning, investigative project, do not read. it was warning, prize entry, do not read. Look, I'm the first to acknowledge that there are, some 20-part series that really do produce reader fatigue, and that part of the art of strong investigative reporting is suggesting to the reader why it's relevant to her, and an effort that doesn't do that is falling short. But I don't think that the Pulitzer Foundation and other prize givers was the only reason that investigative reporting thrived in the last 30 years. I think it very definitely fit the business model that large metro newspapers were operating under in that period of time. I mean, what happened in the early 60s, just as I was getting into the business, was that you had first a collapsing of what had been a broadly competitive multi-morning, multi-afternoon newspaper environment in most American cities, to one in which there was one morning paper and one afternoon paper. Walter Cronkite came around, and the afternoon papers essentially became either extinct or second cousins, and a dominant morning paper achieved a near monopoly position in city after city after city. And in that kind of environment, they became more and more profitable, and investigative reporting and foreign reporting became part of the barriers to entry. In other words, if you wanted to compete with the Los Angeles Times in the 70s when I was working there, not only did you have to put down several hundred million for presses, but you would have to incur millions of dollars of operating expenses to match the Times with its, you know, Washington Bureau and its overseas correspondence and its investigative reporting. Maybe not dollar for dollar. Maybe one could have picked places to emphasize where the Times was vulnerable, but certainly the existence of that level of coverage gave the Times a kind of impact in its community that it was in that environment very difficult for even a pretty well-financed competitor to enter the field. So I don't think it was inconsistent with the business models that obtained at that time. Enter the internet and all bets are off, and to steal the phrase from Harvard, each tub had to sit on its own bottom, and then that grouping became no longer so valuable.
I actually want to sort of take Steve's point a little bit different. The way you just described it was that you essentially had these fat cat monopoly newspapers that were making so much money that they could afford the extravagance. I'm deliberately exaggerating here, but could afford the extravagance of investigative reporting and foreign reporting. And so in a way, although it's not a not-for-profit model, it's a extraordinary for-profit model that may never exist again, which is somewhat similar. In other words, these people did not have to do that in order to continue making money. They did it because they had such extraordinary wealth that they were able to. Is that your take on it, or do you have a different take?
Certainly the profits were substantial, but I don't think it would have been done simply as vanity. I mean, after all, they could have spent it on art, and that would have been, in many ways, much more fun. Because when you spend it on art, you're not likely to get angry phone calls from important advertisers, complaining about the coverage. So, I think that this fit the sense of purpose of the owners of these journalistic enterprises, and it contributed to their business success. It was not done simply because they had a strong income stream, but the two fit together very, very well and help perpetuate each other.
Other questions? I know Louise had her hand up.
Hi, I'm Louise Swan. I'm from the Health Media Initiative, which is part of the public health program here at OSI. And I'm sorry, I'm coming back to the issue of philanthropic support of, for instance, websites, investigative journalism. And I'm just wondering about an inattention there in terms of, I suppose you could call it editorial independence. OSI, the media program, for years has been working outside the US, in Eastern Europe, Africa, and other areas, to develop proper free press. And I come from the sector where we're wanting to engage with journalists and to discourage what has become a tradition of being where NGOs working often with marginalized groups, injection drug users, sex workers, all the people who are very easy to moralize beyond the pale, but to encourage those groups not to offer to stump up a lot of money to get articles published in newspapers that are often poor journalism and read as propaganda, but to engage with journalists and offer up what are often very good stories that can be investigated. And of course, what we're dealing with internationally is the juniorization of the newsroom, where if journalists are any good, the investigative reporters of tomorrow, they get snapped up by governments to work in their PR departments. But there's also, as here, there is this beginning of this trend of international funders funding investigative journalism websites. It's at the early days, but it's beginning to appear, and it is tempting, Public Health Watch mentioned, to think of this idea of non-profits supporting investigative journalism in this way in websites. But I wonder about that issue of editorial independence. To what extent is the funding tied to particular areas of coverage? Because I think it's a trend, it's tempting. You know, if in areas where, like Eastern Europe, where there's poor journalism, and yet the sparkiest journalists are starting these great websites, offering links to international newspapers or whatever. It's tempting to see it, and I think it's something to seriously consider, but there are issues to consider as well.
I mean, I think it's doable. I think these problems can be overcome, and I think that there is certainly, I did not mean to suggest that there's no further opportunity for philanthropy. I think there's a big opportunity for philanthropy to focus on these areas which are being underserved, and investigative is certainly very high on the list. And you know, internationally, nationally, and particularly locally. And I think the issue of bias or perceived bias is, I don't want to be Pollyannish about this, but I think it's sort of, you know, by their fruits you shall know them. If you do stuff that demonstrates that you're willing to gore oxes on the right and the left, and you say that's your policy and you stick to it, I think people will come to believe you. And on the other hand, if you have a particular point of view, and to me there's nothing wrong with ideologically motivated investigative reporting, that's known for what it is, and people know where it's coming from, but it can also unearth significant facts. There's a role for that too, and I think the danger is getting them mixed in the public mind. So it's very important to us that we create awareness of our name, and that we're aimed at going down the middle, not working one side of the street or the other. And I think other people can adopt that too.
Laura Silver, the Open Society Institute. I have a question. I recently heard the executive editor of El Diario on some NPR show, and he was boasting that, in fact, his newspaper was thriving, as was a lot of ethnic press newspapers throughout America. And part of it was that he suggested that the other national newspapers lost touch with their readership, and the other part was saying his readers weren't online as much, so that was a component. Yet he also suggested that, you know, that they were able to have intensive local, national, and international reporting in a way that that national newspapers are now strapped to do that. Is there any insight that you might have as to why that model would work? Why is that model working and others are not?
I think one of his two points that the audience is not doesn't have as many opportunities on the web. I mean, I think that there is a there's a growing Spanish language news flow on the web, but it's still a much smaller than is available in English. And I mean, I think that's an opportunity for entrepreneurs. But in the meantime, there's not a huge competition. And a few years ago, we had a couple of reasonably well-financed efforts to launch competitive forays in the print Spanish language market in the U.S. and they fell on their face. So, I think that if you do a really good job, you know your market, you can make a print newspaper work. Politico, which started as a web-only operation, and all of their intellectual drive was focused on the web. Well, they're making a very handsome return on a print version that they circulate, I think it's once a week, it may be twice a week, to a small but highly desirable, from the Hill down to about 18th and K audience. And because it's handy and it's all politics all the time, it's avidly read, and the advertising has big value. So there are ways that one can still be successful with newspapers. It just is that the print newspaper, as a general phenomenon, and particularly in the metro newspaper, is declining rapidly.
Sasha Post, Open Society Fellowship. So long term, for serious journalism to flourish, we need for-profit models to be viable, right? And it seems like one model is the niche model you're describing. If you're the Wall Street Journal and you're going after business readers, or you're the, I don't know, you're the Hill or your Roll Call or your Politico, and you will service a readership that advertisers will pay a premium to reach, then you can also be viable. But it seems like long term, for online content to the production distribution of online content to be for profit and to be viable, you need either to rely upon eyeballs and advertising, which is hard, or you need to have readers pay for content. And I think you've already talked about the challenges to newspapers to get to there, the trough you would potentially face in terms of eyeballs once you introduce a paywall. So it seems like one issue there is coordination. In other words, it's a challenge, a collective action problem, right? It's kind of a classic collective action problem dynamic where you have to get lots of news producers and distributors together and all agree to only provide their content for a cost. But of course, that raises all kinds of legal antitrust issues, and there's, of course, enormous logistical barriers, I would imagine, to ever having that kind of, to ever reaching that kind of agreement or arrangement. So what is the picture? I mean, what's the game plan? What's the end game?
Very good question. I don't know. you know, sort of the thought of the Grahams and the Sulzbergers and the Murdochs marching with signs, you know, on Washington is kind of an interesting image. But, you know, certainly if the newspaper industry and you know, it's the ASNE, the American Society of Newspaper Editors, is dropping the word paper. You know, if it's news, whether delivered on paper or on the web, if they had some kind of legislative or Justice Department forbearance to talk together, could that produce something? 3 or 4 years ago, no way. These are very independent kinds of people. Could it happen now? Possibly. You know, I mean, I haven't seen any sign that the NAA, the Newspaper Association of America, has got anything like that on its on its docket. But that is conceivable. I mean, another approach is what I think Orville was suggesting, is that one comes up with models that allow for investigative and international and some other kinds of high value to society but low value to advertisers journalism. You create a strong supplement from that, from the, you know, the nonprofit side, and let the marketplace deal with the rest. I mean, that's a conceivable alternative. You know, I mean, my gut says content has value. It's clearly producing value for the search engines. Is there some way, you know, we talk about the artist dying long before he can realize the ultimate value of his work. You know, maybe there's some change in the structure that would allow newspapers to realize or newsrooms to realize the value of what they produce while they're still alive to produce it.
Yes, Stuart Chisholm from the Open Society Institute Media Program. My question is related to libel suits. You had mentioned this is a potential increased threat now for many of the online media, and I was wondering if you might be able to expand on that. Is this an issue you think due to the lack of adequate resources, the issues related to the legal counsel and insufficiencies there? And then secondly, if you could maybe address how you think this deficiency could be addressed. Is there a need for pre-publication advice for online media, or what kind of how do you think that could adequately be addressed?
I mean, this is a very important question, and you know, one of the things that the great economic power of newspapers over the last 30 years allowed to happen was that first within their local markets they were producing serious profits. Then originally for estate planning purposes they went public, but then discovered, ooh, we have this wonderful tool, other people's money, and you know, used it to expand further and then to take over newspapers in other communities. So you had these huge chains develop, McClatchy, Knight Ridder, Gannett, Times Mirror, Tribune, and so on. In that kind of an environment, you've got a legal department and resources, you know, to take on just about any kind of libel suit. Obviously, you didn't want to lose one, but if you at least could not be intimidated by the mere threat of a lawsuit. My experience at the Wall Street Journal, you know, you could get totally meritless threatened lawsuits, and you'd incur $1 million, $2 million in legal costs before you turn around. And these institutions obviously would be driven out of business easily by even in some cases a bogus lawsuit. So what can they do? At night we've talked about giving support to cooperative arrangements, which would allow lots of small news entities to pool their resources and try to combine with some aspects of the defense bar, which is prepared up to a point to provide pro bono help. And as you suggested, you need it in two places. One, if you do get a threat of a lawsuit, but one hopes way before that, because more lawsuits are beaten by good pre-publication advice than in the courtroom, and I think that's a very important direction for the smaller institutions and these startups to think about.
I think I'll close this by asking one last question, which will be about the art of journalism rather than about the business model. You've hired Amanda Mickel. You, having worked for you, I have some sense of the kind of discipline that you make your reporters go through when they do reporting. I presume that you hired Amanda partly to sort of expand your audience participation, the citizen journalism in your reporting. Can you just talk to us about some ideas that you have for how you're going to blend the kind of professional, disciplined core of 28 journalists that you have with what Amanda presumably will do, which will bring in readers to that process?
Sure. I mean, this is her first day, and so it's going to what I long ago realized is that the most important thing is being open to recognizing what I don't know, and so this is a whole domain where I am the ultimate of naivete. But what I've seen so far, and what reason I'm so excited that we're going to be going down this path, is that not only did Off the Bus demonstrate that it's possible to build a very large network of avid citizen reporters, but that they can get into places that the journalists can't get into because the news sources, like political campaigns, have learned that you keep them under control. You know, you have them on the bus and you have them in the pen over here so that they're not going to hear the off-the-cuff, unscripted, unthought-through quote. So what it's clear that this approach offers is an opportunity to get to places and get to people either where and whom you can't reach now or that you can't reach in unscripted moments. But then when you do come up with something, you've got to put it through the same journalistic traps that you would use now, but I think that's eminently doable.
Paul, thank you very, very much for coming and sharing your insights, and thanks to all of you for participating.